This is Steve Maxner conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Michael Harris. I am in Lubbock, Texas. Mr. Harris is in Coos Bay, Oregon. It is the 22nd of August, year 2000, at approximately 10:15 Lubbock time. Mr. Harris, would you please begin by giving a brief biographical sketch of yourself?
Okay. I was born on August 3rd, 1948, at the Marine Hospital in Seattle, Washington. My father was in the Coast Guard at sea, and both my brother and I were born there. Shortly after, we moved to Oregon. My dad worked on a dam, and then we moved down to North Bend, Oregon, which is adjacent to Coos Bay. And I grew up here from the age of about three and a half years old. I'm still living here, of course, and really enjoy the area. But had a very good upbringing, lived out in the country. Thought that I was robbed because the city guys were able to get away with more, but in retrospect, I wouldn't trade it for anything. I was a good athlete in school, excelled in especially football, most valuable player in high school, and just about an above average student, 2.85 grade average, and when I got close to graduation, I'd heard some about the Vietnam War, but really wasn't privy to what was going on, and decided to follow my brother to Oregon State University and enrolled there in 1967, won a couple terms, and then the draft was after me and made some decisions.
Mm-hmm. And that's when you decided to go in the Navy?
Yeah, I actually chose the Navy. My brother went in ahead of me. I chose the Navy to purposely to stay out of Vietnam. So I volunteered for 4 years. Ended up going to boot camp. After that, I was rated as a radioman through a bunch of testing, which related back to my grandfather and father, who taught me Morse code and typing and things like that. And so while in radio school, the instructor, who I respected very much, put out a plea for a radioman on riverboats in Vietnam, and something just touched my heart, and I thought that I really needed to do my patriotic duty as a young man and go fight against the communist insurgents in Southeast Asia. And so I put that as my number one choice and ended up being selected.
Now, did you, when you first enlisted, you said that you primarily enlisted with the understanding that you would not have to go to Vietnam.
Yes.
What were your objections to Vietnam at first?
Well, it wasn't a political thing. It was just the war issue, and I felt that, you know, to stay away from Vietnam, I would join the Navy because they had less forces in-country Vietnam than most. So, but it didn't work out that way through my volunteering.
Well, I was just curious because I noticed that your post-Vietnam education, you received a degree in ministry.
Yes.
And so I didn't know if perhaps you had a certain moral inclination towards not going over to fight the war.
No, I was a non-believer before going over. I went over and just survived by my own skills and desire. I actually felt guilty for years for hoping that the other guys would get it before I did, not in a selfish sense, picking out certain people, but just the will to survive leads to something like that. But I can see now that most people dealt with the same thing. So I didn't have a Christian background before going, and as a result, probably 13 years after Vietnam, I made that choice to believe and go into the ministry.
Okay. And did you choose radio training when you first enlisted? Did you choose to become a radio man?
No, what the Navy does, they have a battery of tests you take, and if you show up high on clerical, you end up being a yeoman, which is like a secretary or a personnel man or a radar or whatever. And My test score showed that I was good in Morse code and typing skills and those kinds of things, so the Navy just selected me to be a radioman.
Okay. And Let's see. You went to boot camp at the NTC San Diego.
Right.
What was that training like?
Well, it was quite interesting. Being a rather good athlete, it was a challenge for me. I'd gone to Oregon State for a couple of terms and was really burned out quickly because of the stress and distress of it all. And so when I joined the Navy, going to boot camp was a super challenge after training for football and other sports. And a lot of guys had trouble with it, but I really enjoyed it and excelled and became a squad leader and just really enjoyed the disciplinary part of it and the fact that it was a whole new direction in my life.
Mm-hmm. And were there any disciplinary problems or incidents while you were in training in boot camp?
There were with other individuals. I recall that actually, at the time I went through, you have companies of about 60 guys, and there were many companies going through at the time, and we heard rumors of a couple attempted suicides, and there were people that were, a small amount of people that were jumping the fence and going AWOL, and the boot camp actually had a disciplinary group called 40-50, if I recall, and these guys would wear red helmets and carry two buckets of sand around everywhere they went because of disciplinary reasons. And mm-hmm. It was really an impact on all of us because we sure didn't want to be doing that. But other than that, it was typical hard discipline. Stay with it and you'll mm-hmm. survive.
Mm-hmm. How did they enforce discipline in training?
Well, it was pretty much orally, verbally. It wasn't, I don't recall ever seeing anybody physically hit or attacked in any way. It was just through verbal discipline and also demerits. If you didn't fold your clothes right or whatever, mm-hmm. you not only suffered, but your whole company suffered. So mm-hmm. it was a push towards a team effort, which I was used to in sport.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about physical aspects like push-ups or pull-ups or anything like that?
Oh, we did it all. I mean, it was, regimen started at 5 in the morning. Being athletic, it was no problem, but there were some things that I wasn't used to, like we had M14 rifles that we would have to hold straight out from our chest at arm's length mm-hmm. for long periods of time, so that strained muscles that you didn't strain before. But all in all, it was very, very good. We learned to march from a real chaotic situation into a very disciplined marching unit of 60 guys. So it was good for all of us, really.
Okay. Anything particularly memorable about boot camp?
Well, I guess the most memorable event to start with was my brother had gone a year ahead of me, and he told me when I arrive, they're going to ask for volunteers, and usually you don't volunteer, but he said, volunteer, and you'll be chosen for a higher position. And so I put my hand right up, and I was chosen initially for a right guide, which led the company in marching mm-hmm. the pace. I'm short. I'm about 5'6", and so my legs are short, and the tall guys got upset with me because my stride was shorter, but eventually they moved me to a squad leader, which had its benefits. There was times I didn't have to stand watches, and I could have a lot more freedom than a lot of the other guys, so that was kind of a prideful merit thing on my part.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
And do you think that this was good training? Was it effective? Do you think it helped prepare you for what you had to deal with later in the Navy and in Vietnam?
Yeah, it was adequate for general Navy or naval purposes. There were a lot of things that didn't apply and a lot of things that did. For myself, I went right into basic electricity, electronics school after boot camp, and then I went on to Radium and A school, and then after that, International Morse Code School, and none of that really applied to my situation, because I went to Vietnam on those boats, and we just had voice circuits. So I was a machine gunner and talking on voice circuits. But I think, in general, the discipline and the training and everything really helped a lot of guys learn about the Navy and what to expect. And then as they moved into their specific rate, or they could adjust to that according to their specific training for that.
Okay. What was the most difficult thing for you to do or adjust to when you went into boot camp?
Well, I kind of like the whole situation. I remember one specific incident where it's still close to my heart. There was a young black man from Louisiana, Opelousas, Louisiana, who was very timid, and he was not as smart as some others, and he really got some bad demerits, and they came down on him and real hard. And so I befriended him. Being from Oregon, there was no racial issues here on the Oregon coast or anything, and so I befriended him, and the first thing he said to me is that his mother told him not to talk to white people, and it was really a shock to me. But we went on from there, and I began to show him how to fold his clothes and things like that, and he began to really accelerate and came out of it real well, and it made me feel good, and it made him feel good, and we became good friends for that short period of time.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any contact with them after boot camp?
I tried here in the 80s or 90s, and I found out he was a truck driver, but I haven't been able to get a direct response with him yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So you went on to basic electricity and electronics.
Uh-huh.
What was that training like? What was the focus of it? What were the most difficult aspects of that?
For me, it was really difficult, even though it was a basic training. When you started getting into electricity problems and math and ohms and amps, and still today I struggle with it, but it was a good preparation for, radium and A school, which was the next step. But it was, I think, 3 to 4 weeks and very intense, so I kind of stressed a bit, but I made it through it.
Mm-hmm. And then you moved on to 13 weeks of Radio Man A School.
Right.
And then this was to basically turn you into a radio man to operate any kind of radios in the Navy, or any was specific to one type of radio or another? Or?
Well, it was in general to train us on transmitters, transceivers, and any type of communication that would be either shore to shore or ship to shore. We had some teletypewriter training, and I really enjoyed it because I excelled because of my background in Morse code and radios. My grandfather was a ham radio operator, so I had some skills there. So I think I ended up fourth or something in my class of however many there were in it. But it was good. The instructor was a very excellent man, a chief radioman who had been around a long time and treated us very, very good for being just seamen radioman. So it was a good experience for me.
Now, you mentioned that you had experience with Morse code. What kind of experience was that before you went into the Navy?
It was being that my grandfather was ham radio and my father had interest there too. Mm-hmm. They taught us that, and I was also in Boy Scouts, so we had to learn Morse code there. So, I was fairly skilled. I knew all the Morse code dots and dashes and everything, so I just kind of breezed right through that. But in reality, I never, ever used it in the Navy at all.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And you were required to perform tests using Morse code in your training?
Yeah, in Radioman A school, we didn't so much. We learned about Morse code and the alphabet and everything, but after Radioman A school, then is when we went to International Speed Morse Code School, which required us to receive 22 words a minute and send 17 words a minute, which was pretty stressful because once you lost your concentration, it was over. So they expected you to reach that goal, and then you would pass, and that would be it. So we were almost like ottoman or monkey sitting at this typewriter, trying to, with a headset on, trying to keep up, and one guy would pass, and it would be a pressure thing, you know. So.
Mm-hmm.
But it was quite interesting. We all finally made it, but it took a little while.
Mm-hmm. And the Radio Man A School, was there any problems there as far as discipline or?
No.
Everybody pretty much?
No, it was very smooth. You know, in the Navy, as with any other service, you kind of graduate in levels. And so when we entered boot camp, you were on the real worm sleaze side of the base, you know, and you wore a blue ball cap, and everybody knew that you were scum, you know. But you graduated over the little bridge and canal to be able to put on your Dixie cup, we called it, your white hat, and,
mm-hmm.
and be able to get around. And then once you graduated from boot camp, you gained a lot more respect from the people you were around because of the disciplinary thing. They wanted to mold you into something, a person that was qualified to handle naval procedures and stuff. And so by the time we got to Radio Man A School, like I said, the instructor was very, very nice, and so we felt worthy there and didn't have any discipline problems at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you said that it was your instructor during Radio Man A School that gave the appeal for Ben to volunteer to go to Vietnam as Radio Man.
Right.
Could you summarize the his position on that? You know, how did he appeal to you? What did he say that was so moving?
It was quite interesting. You know, at that time in your naval enlistment career, you've finally reached a point where you have somewhat of a choice of a duty station of where you could be next. You know, of course, a lot of people think Rota, Spain, and all these glamorous places, but very seldom you ever got what you put in for.
Mm-hmm.
So this man stood up there and gave us the criteria for applying. They gave us a sheet of paper, and you had, like, if I recall, three different choices, and you could just put in. There was a list of where communication stations and such where you could go, or ships or whatever. And he versed us on what we were to do, and then right at the end made a passionate appeal that, you know, there were need for radio men in Vietnam on small river boats, and that he asked us to consider that aspect,
mm-hmm.
as we were making our choices. It wasn't a political thing, like, hey, we got to win this thing. It was just kind of a respectful thing, to where he was saying, as radio men, now we've graduated. Now we've got a duty to do, and he just projected that one aspect to be able to make our choice,
mm-hmm.
and did it very well. Not a guilt trip or anything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did many others volunteer for Vietnam from that?
Well, it's quite interesting, Steve, because I personally didn't admit that I volunteered for Vietnam for 16 years after I was out of the Navy. That's the kind of stigma that went with the Vietnam vet and what happened, and the activists being against the war, that you afterwards you just didn't come out in the open and say, here I am and I did this or that, you know. But I remember that one of my best buddies volunteered, and we didn't know that for 16 years that either one of us volunteered after we finally got together. And another best buddy, Bob Buchanan, didn't volunteer, but he got it anyway, and it was quite a trauma for him. It was a trauma for all of us, but it was especially traumatic for him because he definitely didn't want to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So there were, I can recall four or five that ended up in the same river squadron as myself in Vietnam.
And you didn't talk about it even at the time that you filled out those forms for your first duty station.
No, it was kind of, I don't know what it was. There was a pride involved, the macho issue. Do you, you know, and you would think that you know, guys would stand up and say, yeah, I volunteer for those riverboats, but I don't recall that happening. We all just silently submitted our choices, and they came back, and the day that we sat in a classroom and the orders were read,
mm-hmm.
it was something like, you know, Freddie Breland, Republic of Vietnam, River Assault Squadron 15, mm-hmm. and then the next guy, you know. So I don't recall us all saying that we volunteered. It just took place that way with the era and the time, mm-hmm. you know, with our forefathers, World War II and Korea and everything. We just did what we felt was right in our hearts.
And do you recall about the percentage of men that were assigned to Vietnam when they came in and, you know, called out everybody's name and told them your duty assignments?
I would say it would just be a rough guess, but maybe 5 or 6 out of 30, something like that.
Okay. Well, is there anything else you wanted to talk about with regard to your Radio Man A school?
Well, I was proud to become a radio man because of my heritage. My grandfather spent 41 years in the Coast Guard, which is pretty phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
His last 20 years or so were at a lighthouse here in, off the coast in Coos Bay, Oregon. And my father spent 9 years in and wanted to stay in, and they put him out due to a decrease in personnel in 1949. And I have a couple uncles that were in for 26 and 33. So I never intended to be a career Navy man. In fact, I upset a lot of them because I went in the Navy instead of the Coast Guard. and probably could have pulled some strings and gone into the Coast Guard with the clout that my grandfather had. But the aspect of the radio man was, I was very proud of that because my grandfather was and my father were kind of pushing in that direction, and it just kind of worked out that way. So they were extremely proud of me to be a radio man.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what about that Speed Morse code school? That was 2 weeks long.
Yeah.
And how long, do you remember how long it took you to hit that, to meet the requirement, 17 receiving and, what I mean, 17 transmitting and 20 receiving or 22 receiving?
Yeah, I think it seems like it was like a week and a half or something like that, you know. And what really amazed me was some of the guys that had never had any Morse code experience whatsoever were right up there doing the same thing as myself, mm-hmm. Who had some training. So, mm-hmm. But there was a lot of pressure. Like I say, we had headsets on. We'd sit there and Morse code would just pound past our ears, and we'd try to keep up typing it, you know. And once you got a little behind, you were lost, and that was it. I mean, it was like you knew that you couldn't catch up, so you'd have to try again. So it was constant training and then testing, training, testing, training, testing. Mm-hmm. I believe that everybody that was in the class passed. They probably worked it out that way that, you know, you would move on anyway.
Mm-hmm. Now, and also, was there actually a limit to the amount of time that you had to do this, or was it, you know, kind of, we'll do this until everybody's finished?
Well, I think it was probably understood by the instructors that it was a two-week class, and that everyone would qualify within that 2 weeks. You
mm-hmm. Okay. And you said, but you really never had to use that.
Never did. Never.
Maybe.
You know, I suppose, you know, if a individual was captured or something like that, you would probably use it, but we didn't use it in any of our communication at all.
Okay. All right, following your Speed Morse code school, you went on to Mare Island Naval Shipyard for small boat training.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what kind of boats did you receive your training on?
My personal boat was an armored troop carrier, which, if you recall, in World War II, Korea, the boats that in Normandy, during the Normandy invasion, they came up on the beach and the ramp dropped and the people ran out, and infantry. And it was an LCM-6 that was converted, heavily converted, to a ironclad war-type boat. So, I'm just guessing, but the boat may weigh, say, 15 tons to start with, and when they had it heavily armored and plated and everything, it might weigh 40, 50 tons. And But the ones we trained on were the original LCM-6. So it was a lightweight. It wasn't as broad, or the length was the same. But it was very similar. You know, they wanted to train us in the Sacramento River Delta, which was similar to the Mekong Delta in Vietnam. And so they would take us out, and we'd stay overnight, and they'd set ambushes for us and things like that. But there were other boats in our squadron that were different. There was a monitor that either had a 40-millimeter cannon or a 105 howitzer on the bow. There was what we called the Zippo, which was the flame boat, which had two napalm turrets that could shoot napalm up to 200 yards. There were a special design on a mine-sweeping boat called an assault patrol. I forget the acronym, but it's ASPB. They were designed with sonar to go ahead of the column of boats to detect the depth of the rivers and canals and also sweep for mines. And then there was a command communication boat that was the one that officers would stay on, that was highly powered with radios and such to keep communication going. It was the only boat that had air conditioning to keep the radios cool and everything. And so basically we had that little group of boats. The predominant boat was the armored troop carrier that I was on. We had each division had 13 of those, and the monitors were only like two and one command boat and a couple ASPVs. So all of the exact replicas were not there for training. We just trained on similar boats to be able to get the feel of everything.
And that training, did it focus on like riverine tactics and I guess for you specifically, the use of the radio on those ships, on those boats rather, and stuff like that? Or what did your average training day encompass?
It was pretty well broad-based. There was a lot of discipline as far as the physical activities. They gave us jungle fatigues right away, and we were up at 5 in the morning jogging anywhere from 5 miles before breakfast or whatever. And again, stressing the team unity, the cross-training for the boat crew, like the armored troop carriers had 7 individuals on the boat. We tried to cross-train as well as we could. If someone was injured or killed, we could take over for them and get us out of a bad situation. A lot of the training was class-type training to, like you say, in riverine tactics, the enemy tactics, how they would set ambushes, what they would do. Then we would have a phase of gunnery training, which was pretty intense, on stripping down 20-millimeter cannons, 50-caliber, 30-caliber machine guns, M16s, 45s, whatever. And the main thrust was to prepare us as best they could for what we were to expect, which is kind of a reasonable facsimile to the real thing. You know, you can only train so much for combat, but once you're there, it's a whole new thing. So you adapt once you're there. But I think the training was very adequate in preparation for what we were to face.
Did many of your instructors have experience in Vietnam?
I remember there were some, yeah. There were people who had been on the rivers, and they were able to talk straight to us. I remember one instructor talking about, he just addressed the class and said, look at the man next to you on each side. Some of you are going to be wounded, some of you are going to be killed, you know, and at the time you're just going, wow, this is true, you know, and it happened. We got over there, and there were wounded and killed in our own class, many of them. And so what was kind of unique about our situation was being radiomen. As we went through the boot camp training and basic electricity and then radio school and then Morse code school, and then we went on to this boat training, gunnery training, and survival training. So we were actually trained for up to 9 months before we went to the war zone. So you had a lot of time to think about what was ahead and the possibilities of what could happen.
And what kind of weapons training had you received up to going to the small boat training, you know, boot and in basic electricity and radio man A school? Had you handled weapons very much? Or?
Very, very basically. I mean, we handled the M14, and in training we all had an M14, and you'd put it in a rack, you'd take it out, and it was pretty much for exercise. And then they would take us to the range for a very brief time. You'd shoot, you know, the M14 is all I recall at that time, and that was it. So, you know, it's not expected that many would be going to the war zone. So once we got to Mare Island in Vallejo, California for a training, they took us down to that. We did a lot of assembling, disassembling weapons and weapons logic and things like that in Mare Island. And then they flew us down to Camp Roberts, California, which to this day I don't know where it is. I think it's close to Santa Cruz somewhere. But anyway, it was an Army base, and they took us down there, and we had a lot more intense weapons training. I think it was maybe for a week or so, and we were trained on the 40-millimeter cannon and M16, the machine guns and grenades and different weapons that we would expect to use. But still, I think it could have been more intense, you know, as far as a longer time and some more hands-on type use of the weapons per individual.
Did you feel that way, especially after you got to Vietnam, that you wish you'd received more hands-on weapons training?
Not really. When we arrived, we adapted extremely well. I mean, you had a job to do, and you had a machine gun and ammunition, and you knew how to tear it apart. And the rest was just practical experience. When you got in an ambush, you operated the gun. So I wouldn't say it hurt us, but I just feel that, you know, we could have had some more training, which would have probably built some confidence. A good example is the 20-millimeter cannon that was on most of the boats. There was at least two on most boats, and it's a World War II designed weapon for anti-aircraft fire. And you may have recalled seeing them in the movies or the film strips where they have two round canisters on each side, and the ammunition is fed by gravity down into the chamber. Well, on the boats, they decided to use them, but they put a big ammunition box down below, and they would draw that ammunition electrically up into the chamber. And often, due to the strain of the pulling and the awkward position of the ammunition, the gun would jam, and when it jammed, a round would invariably cook off in the chamber because of the heat of the weapon. And we had a lot of guys injured due to own friendly explosions in their gun mounts and things.
Did that happen in training at all?
No, we our training, I don't recall even training on a 20-millimeter. It seems like we just had the 40-millimeter and then the 50 caliber and such. So I don't recall even seeing a 20-millimeter then. I mean, we had them there to disassemble and reassemble, but I don't recall firing them.
Yeah. And while you were in the small boat training, do you recall receiving updates about what was going on in Vietnam, you know, new tactics, things that the Vietnamese were doing, the Viet Cong in particular, since most of the riverine forces operated in areas that were heavily infested with Viet Cong.
Yeah.
You know, the ways of overcoming what they were doing, you know, lessons learned types of literature. Did you receive much of that?
I don't recall really there being a stress so much on that. Even when we arrived in Vietnam in 1968, July of 68, there was still a lot of improvising going on because it was like cat and mouse. The enemy would change their tactics, so we'd have to change our tactics. And there's a good book, small book, written on Operation Giant Slingshot, which was up by Tainan area. I was not involved in that operation, but it describes how tactics were changed and were successful. So it was kind of an ongoing progression of how to come against the enemy, because the enemy would invariably change his method. And when we were in training, the Tet Offensive in 1968 had just happened. The Mobile Riverine Force was credited with saving the Mekong Delta region during that chaos. And I think a lot of that tactics they were using was point blank. I mean, it was like all out assault, and they were being hit, and they would fire back and take care of business. But after that, it was seemed to be more cat and mouse stuff. You know, you'd go down the river, and they would hit you from both sides, and then go into bunkers or foxholes or spider holes, let us shoot our ordnance, and once we were finished, invariably they would shoot again, and we'd open up again. So they had very good guerrilla-type tactics against us. Of course, we were sitting ducks, and they could hear us coming for miles, so they'd set up an ambush and hit us. So, I think as far as the training, it was difficult for the instructors to go beyond the basic, you know, here's what the enemy is expected to do, and here's what you're expected to do.
Okay. And what about the instructors themselves invoking specific lessons that they had learned, those who had been in Vietnam?
Yeah, it was very good because because they had been there, we trusted them. And I mean, if you ever wanted to be attentive in your life, that's the time to be attentive, because these men were conveying stuff that could save our lives and save the lives of others. So we were very, very attentive. But on the other hand, there was a real, I don't know how to say it, there was a real diehard type spirit amongst us, too, to, you know, that we were going to Vietnam, so what could they do to us, you know? So we were kind of pretty rebellious. We were cocky. And this is pretty common for people who haven't seen combat, but once you've seen combat, the cockiness kind of goes away, you know, because the reality hits in. But, you know, we were on our liberties. We'd do a lot of drinking and bragging and have fun and everything. But when we listened to those instructors, we listened very keenly because they had information for us to survive.
Okay. And anything else you want to talk about with regard to your small bow training?
Well, it was a very adequate training, I feel. And, you know, as far as being able to maneuver boats in total darkness in a small canal or river was very important. It took a team effort, so that aspect was very good. We had incidents where we ran into each other, but that happened in Vietnam too, because I don't think I've ever seen darker nights than I've seen in Vietnam. And here you have a column of 15 to 20 boats going down a small canal, and you get ambushed, and there's total chaos. And to this day, I can't even fathom how the boat coxswain, which was the guy that steered the boat, was able to successfully move down the river during this chaos. But I think in the training helped us a lot. They would set up ambushes and shoot whatever they were. They were kind of like a rocket would shoot across your bow, and they were just trying to and they'd have 50 caliber machine guns with blanks, and they'd fire away. And, you know, it just kind of helped us with the reality of what we were going to face. But again, once you're there, it's a whole new on-the-job learning experience.
Okay. And the actual pilot of the boat, I'm sorry, what was the crazy.
It's coxswain, which is a coxswain.
Coxswain.
Yeah.
Did they use night vision goggles?
No. No, it was we did have a night vision device, which in terms of what we have today was very archaic. It was a cumbersome thing about 2 feet long and everything, called a starlight scope, which was excellent. I mean, you could look out there and you could see very clearly the people walking around and whatever, but it would be impossible to use it going down the river. So basically, the boat captain, which was usually an E6 or above, would be sitting high up to where he could see good enough to inform the coxswain, who was down in what I consider a real hole, to where he could only see straight ahead and very, very difficult to see out. And so the boat captain would guide him down the river. We had sound-powered phones, which we were all supposed to wear during the bad times, and it was a voice-activated headset system that you could talk to one another during the ambush and work your way through it.
Okay. And then you went from your small boat training on to the gunnery training and then survival school or SEER training.
Right.
You've already talked a little bit about the gunnery training. What was survival school like?
It was, again, a challenge for me, being from the Pacific Northwest myself. We were supposed to go through training in Coronado, California, which was the main SERI training area. And SERI is survival, escape, resistance, and evasion, I think, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, plans changed, and we ended up going through up in Whidbey Island, Washington, which was extremely familiar ground for me, being from Coos Bay here. I mean, it had all the familiar surroundings. So the thrust was to enforce discipline, obedience, and to be able to survive in situations where you wouldn't expect to be in. We, right off the bat, we started some classroom training. They stopped feeding us. We didn't eat for like 3 or 4 days, 5 days, something like that. They gave us a couple rabbits to make a stew. I shouldn't say we didn't eat at all. We were just had to fend for ourselves, and I don't recall. I think we had over 100 people in the training, so a couple rabbits in a stew didn't go very far. But it was, again, that discipline, and we actually did catch a rabbit during it. Wasn't a very big one, but we caught one and we were able to throw it in, and I was able to use some of my skills to go down and get some clams, freshwater clams, and we tried eating some bugs just to try them. We weren't starving. So it was a good training. There was a counter-communist propaganda movies they showed us. It was a pretty extreme in a sense, because we were the captives, and the people who had us captive would treat us as such. We weren't supposed to give anything but name, rank, serial number. Our officers especially took a lot of flack. They would physically be slapped, intimidated in front of us, coerced into trying to get information out of them. I respect them. There was a Commander Deal, excellent officer who led us into battle later. Lieutenant Farrar and others were very capable and very good role models for us. But as enlisted people, we did our best to survive the situation. They would particularly try to intimidate us into talking, and I recall one time they put us all in a 4x4x4 box, and each one had a box, and you spent like 12 hours in that box, and they just constantly walked around and thumped your box, and when they thumped your box, you had to give a certain number. If you didn't give your number, they would pull you out and slap you around some. But the idea was to cause you to stand up the whole time for 12 hours and just wear you down.
Mm-hmm.
as the enemy would. And then the secondary phase, which I really hated, was they had a little box, and they had slots in it to where you could make it smaller or bigger depending on the size of the man. Well, me being 5'6", they put it as small as possible, and they made you cross your legs and bend over and get in the box, and then they shut it, locked it with a combination lock, and left you in there for maybe 20 minutes, which seemed like 20 hours. And I remember, you know, I'm pretty claustrophobic, and I just would sing to myself and try to stay sane, really. And there were people around me that were screaming to get out, and I don't blame them. That was a real tough situation. But and then the way they put you in with your legs crossed, when they opened the box finally, they would tell you to jump out and stand at attention. Well, you couldn't because your legs were asleep, and then they'd slap you around because you didn't obey them, you know. And these were actual Navy enlisted people who were the enemy to us. So it was quite interesting that maybe E3 or E4 could slap an officer around, you know. But I remember the instructor threatening to put me back in the box, and within me I was just crying out, no, don't put me in. But I didn't want to show him that. But while in the box, I remember doing the one little, two little, three little Indians just to keep my sanity, you know. But very good training in the sense they had a POW compound. They'd put us in a compound. They would make us dig a hole and then fill up the hole. You know, it was kind of with these things like, I want all these rocks over there. So we'd all move them all over there. No, I don't think I want them there. I think I want them back where we just moved them, you know. And it was just continual intimidation, lack of sleep, no food, which wore us down really good.
Harassment,
yeah. And from the beginning, before we went into that POW situation, they encouraged us to escape. And that was on my heart. You know, I mean, that's what they wanted us to do, somehow figure out a way to escape. Okay, so we were on a work party, and I saw an opportunity, and I broke out the gate and ran along the wall where they couldn't see me. But the instructions were to go out into the woods, wait for 20 minutes, and then come back in. Well, I came back in. They slapped me around in front of my guys and said they shot me and everything, you know, and it was more intimidating. So on top of that, they put me up on top of the POW compound with a rifle with no ammunition, guarding my own troops, you know. And I'm thinking, what is going on here, you know? And the troops didn't mind. They respected that I tried to escape. And so while I was up there, there was a machine gun compound to my right, and it was basically a rectangle. I had to walk around a catwalk about 12 feet in the air. And so I just kept watching the machine gunner, and when he was busy, I saw an opportunity to jump over a fence and down 12 feet. And once I hit the ground, there was one little area, about maybe a foot and a half wide, where I could get between another wire and a tree. And so I just kept walking around waiting for that opportunity. And when he was busy looking the other way, I set the gun down and jumped over there and was able to get through that opening and into the woods before anybody saw me. And I remember them start shooting, and it was like somebody had a .45 and they were chasing me through the woods, I thought, but it wasn't happening. But I would run, and I would jump over and hide behind a log, and my heart was beating so loud that it sounded like somebody was running right up to me. And so I would jump and run again, and it was due to the fatigue of no sleep and no nutrition, I was just wasted. And finally I got down to the area we had been before, and I just lay down and fell asleep for probably a half hour, 45 minutes, and worked my way back to the camp. And when I walked in the main gate, they slapped me around again, and I thought, well, here we go again. But this was for the purpose of intimidating my fellow POWs, and they took me in the room, and they all congratulated me and said what a great job I did, and gave me a couple hunks of celery and a canteen cup to drink all the coffee I wanted, and 20 minutes to take a nap.
Mm.
And that was like winning the lottery, you
mm-hmm.
know. And I remember, I didn't remember at the time, but I put half a stalk of celery in my sock and took it out and gave it to my best buddy at the time. So he reminded me of that 16 years later.
Uh-huh.
But there were only two that escaped during the whole training, and the other guy was actually on my boat too. So it was pretty gratifying to know that just to go in there and see your captors congratulate you and
mm-hmm.
and whatnot. So
now, what would have happened if you hadn't gone back in 20 minutes?
Well, I was actually late anyway.
Right.
Know, but I don't think they would have done anything. You know, they realized the extreme situation we were in, and
mm-hmm.
that, you know.
Well, especially the second time.
Since yeah.
The first time, you did what they told you, and they punished you for it.
Right.
And so if you didn't go back the second time, was
right.
there someplace else for you to go?
No. No, we were on an island. So,
if you wanted to eat, you had to go back.
Yeah. Well, I could have tried to swim off the island or anything, but I had no intention to do that. I really knew that second time that I made it because
yeah.
there was no way the machine gun could turn around and
mm-hmm.
train his weapon at me. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, so I just knew I had made it.
Yeah.
And, how
far of a swim was it off the island?
Oh, it was, you know, it's up in the Puget Sound, so it's very cold water. I
uh-huh.
never even considered it. But I imagine if you went the right way, there's bridges and things. You could. I remember the Navy had a air station there somewhere. But
mm-hmm.
there was another situation where they took us into an area, and you really didn't know where you were.
Mm-hmm.
Even afterwards, like I said,
mm-hmm.
I don't even know where Camp Roberts is.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay. Well, let's see here. Well, when did you finally learn that you were going to be going to Vietnam as far as your orders?
It was, I believe, in late October or early November 1967.
Okay. And now, up to this point, what did you think was going on in Vietnam?
I really wasn't privy to a lot of it. Of course, I had gone to Oregon State University for a couple terms, and there was talk about Vietnam, and there were people being subjected to the draft, and eventually I received my draft notice. But as far as the political aspect of what we were doing in Vietnam, the only thing that I really focused on was communism, because we'd been drilled on the communist, you know. So
mm-hmm.
I didn't know really much about the Gulf of Tonkin incident or anything that led up to why we were there. I just knew that people were going there.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think we're actually trying to accomplish?
Well, it was I kind of stuck with that Eisenhower thing about the domino theory and how we were trying to stop that from happening in Vietnam. And in reality, Eisenhower was correct in the sense that South Vietnam fell. Cambodia is ruled by a communist-type Khmer Rouge man, and also Laos fell to communism.
Okay. And did you think that your training that you had received, you know, prior to going to Vietnam, you know, when you were on the, like, how did you travel to Vietnam, by boat or by, or ship rather, or by plane?
No, I was traveled by plane.
Uh-huh.
At that time in the war, 1968, was the highest personnel involvement in Vietnam. I think it got up to 540,000.
Mm-hmm.
So in those times, the government can enlist the private air
yeah.
carriers to take ferry people to the war zone and back. So I actually flew, met an airplane. I thought it was at Oakland Air Base, but it could have been Travis Air Base in California. But anyway, we flew on Braniff Airlines from there to Hawaii for a quick stopover.
Mm-hmm.
We got in some trouble there, and they threatened to keep the plane there, and we all cheered. You know, we were all drunk the night before and everything. Then we went from there to Clark Air Base in the Philippines for a quick stopover,
mm-hmm.
and then flew on into Tonsonute Air Base.
Okay. Now, upon leaving, did you feel confident that the Navy had really prepared you for combat?
I, You know, again, it's just you're in that kind of middle zone where, you know, you can do all the preparation. Just like, say, a football game, you do all the preparation, you practice all week, and, you know, are you prepared to win that ball game on Friday night? Kind of a more extreme situation of not knowing how you were going to react, how the unit was going to react. I guess it's more in retrospect that I feel that, you know, we were, the Navy did what they could, the best they could, to prepare us for what was to come.
Okay. When you arrived at, well, on the flight over, actually, before we get to actually arriving, did you and your, well, was it just Navy personnel on board that aircraft, or were there other services on board as well?
In our situation, to give you a little history of the Mobile Riverine Force, there were four squadrons, 9, 11, 13, and 15. We were scheduled to be in 13, but then that was filled up, so we went to 15. So we were the brand-new squadron. So we all trained as a unit. Mm-hmm. We all flew over as a unit. So,
okay.
So I'm pretty sure that, you know, 80-90% of the plane was us. I mean, it was just us, which is kind of unique for Vietnam vets because a lot went over individually and came back individually.
Right. Now, the how many men were in a squadron?
There were about 400, if I recall.
Wow.
And each squadron was divided into two divisions, and mm-hmm. so you'd have about 200 in each division.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Pretty sizable unit.
Yeah.
Okay.
But actually small compared to what, you know, considering what we did. You
mm-hmm.
know what I mean?
And how many boats did you have in your squadron?
Let's see. I'll go division first. I think a division had 13, troop carriers, and then we had maybe one monitor, one CCB, and a couple ASPBs. So that's 13, 14, 15, 16, 17.
Mm-hmm.
Probably close to 40 boats per squadron.
Mm-hmm. No PBRs?
No.
Oh.
PBRs were Task Force 115 or 116.
Mm-hmm.
We were Task Force 117. So even though we operated with PBRs during the year in certain situations, they weren't a part of our task force.
Hmm.
And
okay.
then the Swift boats were Task Force 116, or I might have that changed around. I think they were Task Force 116, PBRs 115.
Okay. All right. And so when you were flying over with your fellow Navymen, what did you guys talk about? Did you talk about going to Vietnam? Was it kind of like a quiet time where just people relaxed and reflected? And
well, it was kind of like the night before we left California. I mean, we had an excuse to all get drunk as we could, and it was a real mess because guys were drinking whatever they could get, you know. And I remember one guy had some lime vodka, and we actually wore white uniforms over, and we were filthy, and we were just, you know, had this bravado and this it's not going to be me attitude that really got stopped right away when we got there. But leading up to it, it's like we can do anything, you know. So the flight over was pretty much a real chaos as far as, you know, us being rebellious, saying, what can you do, send us to Vietnam, you know. And like I said, in Hawaii, the captain came over the intercom and said, you know, if you don't settle down, we'll just have to stay here for a while. And everybody just cheered, you know.
Hmm.
What are they going to do? They're going to...
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, you know, it was I suppose there was a lot of inner contemplating about what was ahead, but I think there was a whole lot of outward expression of humor and other things to cover up how we were feeling on the inside.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you arrived at Tonsonet Air Base. What did what were your first impressions?
Well, as you've heard many vets say, when the fuselage door opens, I mean that heat comes in, and it's just so humid that it was just almost took our breath away. I mean, it was definitely a different thing that than we were used to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we took our got off the plane, got our duffel bags and everything, and it was you know, talk about be alert. We were watching everything. Immediately we were introduced to Vietnamese. We were in a situation where we saw hardened combat troops and other people around, and helicopters, and I mean the whole thing was OD green. It was like, here you are, you trained for this, you're here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just waited in anticipation for what the next step was.
Okay. And what was the next step? You know, when you arrived at Tonsonet, what happened?
They had some organizing to do, and then in Saigon there was the Annapolis Hotel, it was called, was a billeting area for Navy personnel. So somehow they got us down to there, and we spent a night, I think it was, at the Annapolis Hotel. Of course, the whole thing is cordoned off with sandbags, and there's screens over the front, all, everything, you know, and we had to stand watch, and M16s, you know, you're just initially scared to death, thinking that everybody that walks by is a Viet Cong, you know. So, but we spent the night there, and then they asked for volunteers but they were going to move us to Vung Tau, which is on the coast, kind of south east of Saigon. I would guess maybe 60 miles, 70 miles, something like that. So they asked for volunteers, and I volunteered, and they put me on the back, amongst about half a dozen of us, on the back of a lowboy truck, watching the duffel bag so they wouldn't fall off during the transit down there. And the rest of the guys, I think, flew down on an aircraft. So here we were out in the darkness of the night riding a lowboy truck, scared to death, and I was wondering why I'd volunteer for this thing, you know. And but I made it down there safely. And after we arrived in Vung Tau, they immediately took us out to the USS Bear, which is spelled B-E-X-A-R, a troop transport ship that was visible from the shore about, I'm guessing, maybe 2 miles offshore. And they put us on there to wait for our boats to arrive. They were brand new from the United States on merchant ships.
Okay. And let's see, what kind of briefings did you receive when you arrived in country as far as what to do, what not to do, rules, regulation, rules of engagement, stuff like that?
Yeah, there were a lot of rules. One of the ones that stands out is, you know, there's such a thing as black syphilis, and if you get it, we'll put you on an island that you'll never, ever return from, you know. And it was basically a scare tactic, you know, because prostitution was rampant, and, you know, here we were, a bunch of 18, 19, 20-year-olds, and so that was one of the things that really stood out with me. But, you know, it was a lot of caution on where to go, where not to go, what to watch out for, don't do this and don't do that. I can't remember specifically what those things were, but we were pretty frightened at that time, I guess, to be able to, you know, do what they said. Later on, as we got hardened, we just rebelled against them and went and did what we wanted to most of the time anyway.
So the threats about putting you on a deserted island if you contracted this particular type of syphilis didn't work.
No, didn't work at all. You know, I mean, we kind of saw through it, you know, they wouldn't do something like that. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the temptation was great. We were put on that barrack ship out there, and every once in a while we could come in for liberty, and we just went crazy. I mean, just a bunch of young kids and a bunch of young girls that were friendly with us, and
mm-hmm.
everything happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what about combat rules, rules of engagement?
Well, it was interesting because, you know, right off the bat, we weren't issued any weapons because our weapons were on the boat. So, you know, maybe the officers were issued 45s, but here we are going around as a large unit of troops with no M16s even, you know. So, and it was commonly known that Vung Tau was a VC R&R center also. And I really believe that, because when we walk around the streets, not only initially when we were really apprehensive, but I went back there in R&R like 6 months later, an in-country R&R, and I really would walk down the streets and see people, men of our age or older, who wouldn't look at you. You know, a lot of people would, but these men wouldn't look at you. They would walk by you, and I really believe they were Viet Cong soldiers there, you know, getting rest and relaxation.
Mm-hmm. Right, so when did you actually get your equipment and start, I guess, operating as Task Force 117?
Okay, the initial staff were there ahead of us, of course, you know, in May or something like that. So they were doing all the groundwork. And while we're waiting on the boats to come, we did a lot of stuff, you know, like stand watches and things that were just ridiculous. But anyway, my boat, out of 13 Tango boats, we called them, the armored troop carriers, in a division, my boat was number one. I was my boat was Tango 152-1, denoting that 152 was the division. We had the River Salt Squadron 15 and 152, mm-hmm. 151 divisions out of that. So being that my boat was number one, when the first merchant ship arrived, less than 2 weeks after we arrived, Tangos 1, 2, 3, and 5 were selected. There were four boats on the merchant ship, and we were the ones. So we rode the merchant ship from Vung Tau up to Saigon. They offloaded the boats into the water. We went over to Cat Lo and Na Bay, which were two bases there, and outfitted the boats, began outfitting them with weapons, with painting, everything. We had to take care of them from the get-go, since they were brand new. So what happened was, since we were the first four boats outfitted, they chopped us, which is they cut us from Riveron 15 to Riveron 13. So we were the first boats to go out on combat operations, while the other sailors waited for their boats to come. And so we were initiated into combat on the first operation with Squadron 13.
Mm-hmm. What was your primary mission
of that operation? Or?
Well, I guess as a squadron, and then your particular, I guess you said it was Tango 1.
Yeah.
Was the name of your boat?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, what role did your boat play in the overall scheme of things for the squadron?
Well,
or the division.
In a division, or let's say a squadron.
Mm-hmm.
The Tango boats, or troop carriers, were kind of the workhorses. They were designed to carry about 40 troops. With Vietnamese troops, you could carry more because they were smaller.
Mm-hmm.
But Riveron, and our whole main goal was to transport troops from one location in the Mekong Delta to another, offload them, let them assault the enemy. We would set up a blocking station, try to catch the enemy fleeing from the assault, so we would go out in anywhere from five boats to, I remember having 33 or 36 at one time in one operation. And the monitor boat with the, since we were a new squadron, we had the 105 howitzer on our monitors. The monitor boat would be the big threat. The Zippo would be with us, which would be the enemy hated them because they could burn them real quick, so they would primarily escort us front and back, the troop carriers, and we would maybe have a couple alpha boats, which were the ASPB, sweeping the river ahead of us, or the canal, because the enemy would put either command detonated mines out, which meaning that they can, whenever one particular boat got over that mine, they could trigger it, or they would just have random mines out for us. So we had to sweep the rivers trying to combat the mines, which didn't always work. We lost some boats to totally lost to mine explosions. So basically, our duty was to transport the infantry troops from one location to another. Since we were the new squadron, squadrons 9, 11 primarily had the 9th Infantry U.S. Troops taken care of. So throughout the whole year, I only remember us moving U.S. troops maybe five times. The rest of the time was primarily Vietnamese Marine Corps or Vietnamese Army, or they had regional forces and popular forces that we would work with once in a while, and they were kind of like National Guard troops, and we called them rough puffs for the regional and popular. So in a nutshell, that was our mission, but you know, we would improvise according to what the officers thought whenever we could.
Okay. What did what were your impressions of the Vietnamese that you were transporting?
Well, initially it was kind of a shock because it was kind of neat to be there. They were our allies, and we were going to go out and defeat the enemy. Well, we outfitted our boats with everything new, and it was kind of unusual. The Navy issued us wool blankets for this tropical climate. They didn't issue us mosquito nets, which the mosquitoes were rampant, you know, and things like that. But here we are with a brand-new boat, brand-new ponchos, poncho liners, and all this stuff. And we go out on our first operation. We take Vietnamese Army troops, and they offload and go into the jungle, and then we realize that they stole 50% of our stuff. We were just naive. We didn't realize. So after that, which was really ironic and humorous, we would have a guy sit overlooking 40 Vietnamese troops, and he would have a shotgun, and he's guarding these guys, and they've got 40 M16s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were trying to intimidate them to you know, leave our stuff alone, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but in general, the Army, Vietnamese Army troops called the ARVN, were good fighters and solid troops, but you got to keep in mind that they had, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year tours, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
and the Vietnamese Marines that we worked with predominantly were just excellent fighters. I mean, when we got in ambushes, they wanted the boats on the riverbank so they could go get them.
Mm.
So, and they had, I think, a stronger reason for being there and had a goal because they had been pushed out of the north during the war in early 50s with the French because they were predominantly Catholic. So they went down into the Mekong Delta to try to set up a stronghold for their Catholic faith, you know. So that was a little different. But they were hardcore fighters, and I respect them to this day.
Now, you never received any warnings that you should guard all of your equipment when
no.
the Vietnamese were on board in case someone decided to steal some, huh?
No, nobody said anything.
Well,
it was probably a deal where other squadrons knew it, and they just kind of thought, well, it happened to us, so let's just be quiet, you know. I mean, they didn't steal our weapons or anything, but they stole little things, you know,
yeah.
like radios and poncho liners and mm-hmm. things that, in reality, they would use, but
mm-hmm.
It was kind of a hard pill to swallow at the time.
Yeah. And no incidents after that once you had the guy posted with a shotgun?
No, not really. We didn't miss anything. Of course, we knew by then, so we would... The boats were 54 feet long, which they seems awful long to me now, but they didn't seem that big then. But we had little, maybe 3-foot high lockers that we could put stuff in and lock up when we knew they were on board.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall having trouble with the Vietnamese Marines at all, though.
Mm-hmm. Now, when transporting ARVN units, did you ever have any friendly fire experiences with them?
Well, we had one incident on our boat, which was unique, and I was the guy guarding the troops with a shotgun. And I'll bring this up because, it wasn't an intentional friendly fire thing, but it was an accident.
Mm-hmm.
They had like one grenade launcher per 40 guys. And this guy that had the grenade launcher was sitting down in the bottom of the boat, I was sitting up on the edge, and all of a sudden he shot the grenade launcher in the boat. And, you know, it has a familiar sound, you know, and the grenade went up and hit a strut that holds our miniature flight deck up, bounced off the underneath the flight deck and fell right down in the middle of the troops.
Oh,
no. And with an M79 grenade, it has to turn so many times before it's activated.
Mm-hmm.
And it hadn't turned that many times, so everybody flooded to the back of the boat and to get away from it, including me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it almost sunk the boat because everybody's back there.
Mm-hmm.
And they made this guy go back in there, pick up that grenade, and throw it over the side.
Wow.
And when he did, it exploded just shortly after going in the water.
Goodness.
And nobody was hurt, but...
Mm-hmm.
Then they proceeded to beat this man up and discipline him for that incident.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but as far as friendly fire with the Allied troops, I recall one incident where we let off Vietnamese Marines, and this was very sad because it was a guerrilla tactic by the enemy. We let the troops off. We were in a very, very bad area, and they penetrated the jungle, and we went down river for maybe an hour, and then we came back up river, and the enemy got between them and us and opened up on us, and we opened up on them, and we just really annihilated a bunch of Vietnamese Marines that we had just dropped off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So those incidents happened. I remember one time we were going around a Snoopy's nose type thing, and the boats were strung out for quite a ways, and I was on the back stern of the boat. And the enemy did the same thing, opened up both ways, and we ended up shooting at each other. And I can still see the heavy weapons. You know, you can't see the projectiles, but it was tearing up the jungle and everything right beside us. And I ran and dove in undercover. You know, we didn't have any injuries, but it could have been bad.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The reason I asked is one of the problems that helicopters used to run into in transporting some Vietnamese units. So they drop them off, come back later to either resupply or pick up, and those units were actually infiltrated by Viet Cong, and they start firing at the helicopters when they come back in. I was wondering if that ever happened with the riverine forces and transporting Vietnamese forces around.
Well, we did have one incident where, and it was Vietnamese Marines, and we had set up for the night on the riverbank in a very bad area. Vietnamese Marines set up a perimeter around us to protect us as well as themselves. And everybody was feeling kind of, you know, casual, standing up on this little miniature flight deck. There were several boats together, and you could step from one boat to another.
Mm-hmm.
And a Viet Cong or NVA soldier penetrated their perimeter, got clear up to within 10 or 15 feet from the boats. We didn't see him, and he just opened up with AK-47 and mowed a bunch of guys down on our boat, on the boats, and killed one and wounded two seriously, and never was caught. You know, it's kind of unusual that he could be that bold to get through that, the Vietnamese Marines of all people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, when you would go out on these support missions, basically supporting the Vietnamese Marines or the Army of Vietnam, what would your tactics change very often? Or would, like for instance, the ships that were, or the boats that were with you to support you with firepower, would they change their ammunition at all, or would specific missions dictate different types of tactics or equipment?
Not really, because, you know, if we had the Vietnamese on or 19th Infantry, it was pretty much the same tactics, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't alter, that I recall, anything. The Vietnamese Marines and the ARVN troops had U.S. advisors with them. So, you know, those officers would work with our officers to determine what was to happen. So, you know, there was nothing that I can recall that we would change just because we had Vietnamese forces on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what kind of fire support could you depend upon? As far as artillery, airstrikes, naval gunfire?
Yeah. We usually had helicopter cover on operations, or they could be scrambled real quickly depending on where we were. So there wasn't always a helicopter in the air above us. When we were in real bad areas, they usually had Cobra gunships available at a moment's notice, or they would be flying over us. Depending on where we were, we had artillery support. A lot of times we operated way, way down south in the Yumen Forest area, which was very, very bad area. So the artillery couldn't reach that area, so they would bring Chinook helicopters in and bring the artillery pieces in and set up temporary fire bases close to us so they could support the troops and us in with artillery. You know.
Okay.
We also had access to fighter jets if we needed them. I don't recall seeing too many, but I do recall seeing some runs come in on us, or for us, but not as often, maybe as an infantry unit would see them.
Why don't you go ahead and describe your first contact with the enemy?
Well, it was our boats had been chopped down to River on 13, four of us boats, and so we were out on this operation. It was not too long of an operation, but I recall it being very tight rivers and tight area. Of course, our first time out, we were pretty frightened and nervous, and it happened to be a situation where when we got ambushed, the enemy actually tossed hand grenades on some of the boats, and it was so tight. And so the experience of facing the enemy and not seeing him firing our weapons was just catastrophic. I mean, the adrenaline was so high that we were just, I was just shaking. When it was over, and invariably during ambushes like that, you would have this physical reaction for 2 hours afterwards, because the insides would shake. You would hope that visibly people wouldn't see your hand shaking, but it was that intense, And then you would hear about the wounded and the killed at times that the reality would set in that could be you. And that's when I began hoping that it would be somebody else before me, because I had no other faith in anything but survival. So extremely intense and an indoctrination that continued on for a year. I mean, I estimated at one time that I was personally involved in 50 to 75 ambushes on the boats, and then several mortar rocket attacks on bases at different times.
Okay. What was the most difficult combat experience you've had? The most difficult operation where you encountered the enemy?
Well, I would have to say it was my boat, Tango 1 and Tango 15210, were chopped out of the main squadron and put down in an air remote area on a very small Vietnamese naval base. What was interesting about it, we didn't operate with the Vietnamese Navy. There was, one ASPB minesweeper there and a couple PBRs. And we had just come out of this area as an entire unit and had been shot up real bad. I recall something like 30 out of 36 boats had taken a direct hit, and the enemy had hit us real hard, and now all of a sudden we were there with one other boat and these couple other PBRs. Our mission was really unexplained. The regimen was to go out one boat go out each every other night, patrol the river at night, all night, on what we call Charlie Canal, which was an extremely volatile canal where we got ambushed before many times as a larger unit. And we would go out with two PBRs, and that was it. The ASPB had left right after we got there. And in retrospect, I can see this was part of Operation Sea Lords as a means to deter the enemy sanctuary down in that area. But it was, to me, it was suicide. I mean, we got in situations where I truly believe we could have been captured by the entire boat crew because we would sit there by ourselves on the river waiting for the PBRs to come meet us. And, but anyway, well, we went out this one particular night. We were there about 6 weeks, I recall, and we went out one particular night and got turned around in the river, and we had dual engines with dual shafts and screws, and we got tangled up in the riverbank and bent a shaft and a screw, and so we had to limp back on one engine back to this little Vietnamese naval base. And we got back and definitely had to have major repair done. And the other Tango Boat 10 had a hole in their fuel tank, and they wanted us to go out so that night so they could get it fixed. And we just told them there's no way possible we could do it. And so they plugged it up with wood and cloth and everything. They went out that night, and we were all sitting around back at the base, and the radio started crackling. They got ambushed. You could hear everything going on, and they Tango 10 had got hit by three or four rockets, and one guy, Barry Barber, got hit right in the chest with a rocket, which just exploded his body all over the boat, and three or four other guys were wounded out of seven. And so they limped back into the base that night, and I can still recall the stench of the smell of gunpowder and blood and everything, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we hardly slept the rest of the night, and then the next morning we were called on, my crew was called on to clean up this carnage afterwards. And so, you know, I can recall the man's intestines being stuck to the flight deck and strung down 6 feet or 8 feet down to the deck, and parts of his skull and jawbone and just pieces everywhere. I mean, it was just about impossible. Well, it was impossible to clean everything up. And the medevac chopper had come in and taken the major body parts, and all we could do was take the pieces and put them in a 20-millimeter ammunition can, and then we lowered it into the river and had a few words, and that was it. But, you know, I mean, that was a serious impact on my life. It just changed everything, you know, as far as my ideals and everything. So I would say that was the most extreme situation that I was in without even being in the actual ambush.
Mm-hmm. Well, were there many other ceremonies like that for other men that were killed?
I don't recall. Our kill rate was actually rather low because we did have armor and protection around us. But I have a copy of the command history of the unit for 10 months or little less than 10 months. We had 185 personnel wounded.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the initial 400. Of course, we had replacements, but I believe throughout the year in Riveron 13 or 15, we had 5 to 8 killed or something like that. So you would think the death rate would be higher, but mm-hmm. for our unit, it wasn't.
Yeah. And you mentioned seven-man crew was on that boat?
Yeah.
Was that typical, even for your boat, about seven
men?
Okay.
On the Tango boats, there was a seven-man crew.
Mm-hmm.
On the monitor boat with the howitzer, there was, I think, a little more, maybe 10 guys. And And, you know, it varied. The Alpha boat, the Sweeper, maybe only had five or six. So. But I would say an average would be seven, yeah.
Now, what weapons, what enemy weapons did you fear the most?
Well, it was the rockets. They had a B-40 and a B-50 rocket launcher. And the best way to explain it, it was like maybe a three-inch tube. And the rocket would have the head on it, and it had fins at the rear of it, and the fins were collapsible, and they would collapse them down and slide that into that tube and somehow trigger it. And the rockets had stages. They would burn through metal and explode and keep going and explode a second and third time. So our boats actually had half-inch rebar around the outsides everywhere possible that were about an inch and a half apart to try to set off that first stage of the rocket. But invariably it would burn on inside and explode, and the shrapnel would go off of all the steel and end up wounding many guys, you know. The second one would be the recoilless rifle, which was even worse, because it could actually go right through an entire boat with the, you know, it would be, I suppose, like a welding torch. I recall the damage done by these rockets. It would look just like you had a cutting torch and you would cut a piece of one-inch metal. It would just burn. One incident, we were just offloaded troops and in a very small river, and I was sitting up on top on the radio and kind of turned to my left, and a Viet Cong stood up. I very seldom saw the Viet Cong, only on three occasions. Stood up with one of these B-40 rocket launchers, took his time to aim at my boat and released the rocket. Big puff of black smoke, and it was the typical slow motion thing. The rocket came, missed me by about 6 feet, missed our boat by about 6 inches. And he was aiming in the place that would do the most damage, and it hit a tree on the other side of us, and a tree fell over. And so I called in. The officer jumped on the radio and wanted to know if anybody saw it, and I told him right where it was. And so they moved a napalm Zippo in there and flamed the area, and there was two dead Viet Cong in a hole there. So that was the most feared weapon. Of course, the mines were always a great fear because they could take an entire boat out. We had one boat, Tango 151-5, run right over a 500-pounder, they estimated, and it just collapsed the boat like a sandwich and killed two Americans and some Arvin, and the boat immediately sunk. You know. So there was always that threat of the waterborne mines.
Now, with the recoilless rifles and the rockets, now one of the concerns about, for instance, RPGs hitting personnel carriers is when the round goes in, you know, it's a heat round. And
right.
it basically, when it penetrates the armor, it creates a super hot gas cloud inside the vehicle that
right.
basically incinerates everything.
Mm-hmm.
Was that concern? Was there a similar concern with the rockets and stuff that would be used, and especially with the recoilless rifle or an RPG type a weapon against the boats?
Not as much concern because an APC was enclosed, but our boats had ventilation. You know, I mean the gun turret tops were open, the coxswain flat area was open, and the well deck where the troops would be was all open. So the gases weren't a concern like it would be in an APC, but it was the shrapnel. I mean, they would come in, and that shrapnel would go everywhere. I when we were in very bad areas, I would sit up toward the front of the boat by the ramp. We had a steel ladder that would go up, and there was a hatch that you could open and go onto the little flight deck. And I would sit up on that ladder because I knew the shrapnel would be everywhere back in the berthing area and stuff. And I think it probably saved me, you know, at times. But I really believe the Viet Cong, they knew where to try to sink our boats. They always invariably shot for the engines and disabled engines, and when they could do that, they would create a chaos in the middle of the river, especially in a tight river, and then we would have to try to work our way out of it while they continued to shoot us up. So, and then they also, when we had troops on board, they would shoot those rockets up at a trajectory where they would hit underneath the flight deck on the inside, preferably, and all the shrapnel would come down on the troops. And that was extremely successful. So they weren't dumb. They knew what they were doing, and, you know, it was close. I took a piece of shrapnel in the forehead and the helmet, just above, about an inch above my skull line, and put a big dent in it, and I know it would have probably penetrated my skull. So you always had it flying around.
And did you, was that pretty much a standard thing? You wore your helmet and you wore a flak vest?
Yeah, we actually had flak jackets, and also we had, not too many people know about it, but we had flak pants, they were called. They were kind of kind of the shape of a old-fashioned swimsuit that you would put around your waist section, and it had protection for your groin area and your buttocks. They were kind of cumbersome, but you know, if you wanted to have children later, you probably it would be best to wear it. So, and then they gave us goggles to wear to prevent some shrapnel, but they would always fog up on us, so we never wore them.
Now the pants, would they? How far down your legs would they go?
They would just be how can I explain it? It would be like wearing a set of briefs, you know, like Fruit of the Loom or Penny's, the shape of that, and it would it came up from the groin area a little bit, maybe about 6 inches wide on each outside hip, and had elastic band under the groin area, and I forget how they attached. Of course, they didn't have the Velcro then, but you know, we didn't always wear them. We just, you know, when we got over there, we were first 3 months, we were just scared to death, and it seemed pretty routine after that, at least for me, to where you were scared, but it wasn't the same situation. It was kind of routine. And then when you began getting short, you got really fearful again that you weren't going to make it.
Now, how you mentioned that the enemy seemed to know what they were doing. They knew where to aim. They knew how to try to hit your boats and things like that. How good was your intelligence, or the Navy intelligence that you received on enemy concentrations, expected enemy contacts, things like that?
As enlisted boat crew members, we weren't too privy to what we were doing and why we were doing the operations, you know. But, of course, the intelligence varied according to if you had an informant or not. You could be led into a bad situation or by a Vietnamese that Chu Hoyed over to our side or whatever. But usually they seemed to know where the concentrations of enemy were. In our particular situation, we worked down in that U Minh area a lot in Rock Gia, Chung Ting province, where, I mean, the enemy, you didn't have to look for him. He was there, you know, and there was a training ground for him. Especially in the U Minh, they had complexes in there, and it was not only Viet Cong, but it was North Vietnamese regular units that were there. And so when we showed up, they shot the heck out of us because they didn't want us around there.
Well, but when you go out on a mission carrying Arvin, either Arvin soldiers or Vietnamese Marines or whoever, wouldn't you get at least some kind of a briefing as to expected enemy contacts? When you go up here towards this particular area, you might run into a VC squad, platoon, you know, it was expected VC snipers in the area, you know, stuff like that?
Well, it was, you know, primarily the boat captain would go to the briefings on the ship. We would tie up to a mother ship boat And a boat captain actually would stay on the ship, but the rest of the enlisted guys would stay on the boat. And we kind of liked it that way because we had a certain freedom there, and it wasn't spit and polish and shine and stuff. But anyway, the boat captain would come back. Depending on his personality, he would fill you in on where you were going and what you were doing. But it was all very vague because, you know, it would be basically we're going out on a projected seven-day operation. We're going into an area that is infested with the enemy. When we're in certain areas, it's a free fire zone on the left side and no fire zone on the right side. And, you know, that would be frustrating at times because invariably the enemy would attack us from the side we weren't supposed to fire on. And, you know, they'd tell us where the friendlies were in the area and things like that, but we just weren't really privy to a lot of the detailed information. And I don't think the boat captains were either. I think the higher command just set up these operations with the Vietnamese, and we just go do them. Mm-hmm. I remember one time we were out for almost 45 days on one particular operation, which is a long time to be out there, you know, subjected to that.
For those lengthy operations, how would you get resupplied?
They would bring in helicopters, and we had certain fueling areas that we would, of course, we had to have the diesel fuel, you know, we'd make our way to the fueling areas, and or they would bring a convoy of trucks and have them sitting by a certain riverbank where we could fuel up and stuff. And a lot of times we did what we could to get duck eggs, chicken eggs, and they had a real good French bread over there that the French had introduced that we could get a hold of at times too. But and then the ice boat would come by and you'd buy some ice from them to keep things cool and stuff. Can we take a quick break? I'm going to have
to absolutely
run to the bathroom real quick here.
Yeah, it has been almost 2 hours. So, you mentioned in one of your responses on the questionnaire that you had experiences with Khmer forces, that is Cambodian forces.
Mm-hmm.
Would you describe that operation briefly?
Actually, it was very brief. I just remember that these troops looked different, and it seemed like the Cambodian troops were a bit darker than the Vietnamese, and there were just characteristics that we could, and we knew they were Cambodian. All Cambodians are called Khmer, so, you know, you don't want to confuse it with Khmer Rouge, because that's a different situation. But anyway, it was just a brief operation, you know, kind of a joint thing, and I think it was political in the sense, in retrospect, that Nixon was trying to get closer to Sihanouk so we could operate in Cambodia without restrictions, and that didn't work out, so he ended up in Kissinger and bombing for a long time before the American public knew it. But anyway, nothing really profound happened on the situation.
Okay. Now, before we took that break, you mentioned that invariably when you would receive orders that, you know, one side of a river, it's a free fire zone, and the opposite side, it's a no fire zone.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like whenever the one side was a no fire zone, that was the side the enemy attacked from. Was that pretty consistent that would happen?
Yeah, it would happen. Any time in war, the tactics are often ruthless, and the poor civilians were in between, you know. I mean, either they would fly the South Vietnamese flag, and if the VC or NVA were there, they'd fly their flag. They had to. They had no other choice. And the enemy would be so ruthless that they would set up in the middle of a village, and when we came by on that, the reason for no fire zone on, say, the left side was due to a friendly village, you know, and they would attack us. And we had one incident I remember where we were passing a village, and we were in this incident we were escorting two Army LCM-6 boats, which are bigger than our boats, and we were escorting them from down south up toward Dong Tam area, and I heard a loud boom, and I turned around, and it was familiar rocket sound, and I saw the rocket rock the Army boat behind us, and it killed one Army guy and wounded a couple others, but at the same time, our left-hand side 20-millimeter gunner opened up in the village. And it was just a response. And I was sitting up on top, and I turned around, and I hit him on top of the helmet with my fist. And when he looked up at me, I gave him the, you know, the across the throat, stop, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he stopped, but I recall seeing people going everywhere. You know, it was a sad situation, but, you know, the tension was so high that you often guys just responded to the enemy attacks.
Mm-hmm. Well, and did he, do you know if he hit anybody in the village?
Well, I can't say for sure, but I saw people scrambling, and a 20-millimeter will travel for, a 50 caliber will travel for a mile, so
right.
A 20-millimeter even go farther. You know?
Right.
So I know that we had to have inflicted injury and death on civilians at times.
Yeah.
Just because they were away from us, and we couldn't see them. You know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you mentioned earlier, you were talking about how loud those boats are, and the enemy could, you know,
mm-hmm.
hear you from miles away. And when you're sitting there in Vietnam, when you were sitting there in Vietnam, did that reality ever give you pause to wonder what the heck you guys were doing? I mean, if the enemy knows exactly where you're coming from. Exactly, you know, probably your strength. They can decide whether or not they're going to engage or not engage.
Mm-hmm.
Did that not ever come up as, you know, a part of a conversation? Or what do we think we're doing? You know, is this really going to do anything productive?
Well, I kind of view war as cancer. You know, I mean, it an infection starts and it just gets worse and worse, and Your men get wounded or killed, and then you're determined to do maim and kill the other side. You know, we discussed the some things that we felt were stupid, like the 20-millimeter cannons cooking off and wounding our own guys. One cooked off of my boat and wounded our guy, and also the tidal ebbs were very strong in the rivers, quite a ways inland, like
mm-hmm.
25, 30, 40 miles inland.
Mm-hmm.
So when the tides were rushing out, here we had a flat ramp pushing against a tide, so we were sitting ducks. I mean,
mm-hmm.
we could maybe go 10 miles an hour, 15,
mm-hmm.
you know, at times. So we discussed those things, but I think we all pretty much succumbed to the idea that we were doing what we could to defeat the communists in that situation by moving troops from one location to another to be able to. And you know, we would hear the numbers, like there were 52 Viet Cong killed in this one situation. And our casualties were low compared to theirs, but still they just kept coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, yeah, there were discussions about that, you know. So, but I don't really recall anybody just wanting to quit and saying, mm-hmm. you know, that's it.
Well, over time, has your opinion? What's your opinion now, for instance, of the type of tactics that were employed while you were in Vietnam compared to the enemy we're fighting?
Well, I don't think it could have been a whole lot different because.
Mm-hmm.
You know, imagine an armored army unit with personnel carriers, tanks, and stuff
mm-hmm.
plowing through the jungle. I mean, gee, you know, I mean, everybody knows
mm-hmm.
you're coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is basically what we had.
Yeah.
And, you know, you hear the army guys talking about hot LZs and stuff like that. Heck, we had a flat river with tree lines on both sides the whole year.
Mm-hmm.
So we were subjected to this, but... you know, there's no way around it when you're an armored unit like that. Each boat had twin V6 or V8 marine diesel engines, 671, so I guess it was six-cylinder, you know, and very noisy, and you get anywhere from 7 to 30 boats, and they know you're coming.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
And so they got plenty of time to set up, but... I don't know. There was a certain pride about it, too, because we were an extremely unique unit. I think we were one of the
most highly decorated Navy units in Vietnam. I know we were because of what we faced, and it you go through your year, and then in retrospect, I don't think there were too many things we could have done differently to because of our cumbersome way of getting around. I do believe, I would like some answers from someone one day, why they left two of our boats down in this hostile area and end up getting one shot up so bad with one killed and several wounded, and then they extract us, you know, like, uh-oh, we better take them back to the main squadron.
What operation did that occur on?
It was the one I described earlier about
the
man being blown up. And
with the rocket?
Yeah.
Okay. What was that part of? Do you recall? It's like, for instance, you mentioned that you worked with part of Sea Lords. Was that part of Sea Lords as well?
Yeah, that was part of Sea Lords. In retrospect, we didn't. I remember hearing about Game Warden, Operation Game Warden, and maybe Operation Slingshot while I was over there, and that was it. But now that I've been a student of trying to find out what was going on and what happened, I can see that there were many different operations, and Sea Lords was one that was specifically united the swift boats, the PBRs, and the mobile riverine force to try to cut off influx of munitions and personnel from Cambodia. So our goal was, in retrospect, was to cut off the along the border there so they couldn't get to the Yuman Forest and other areas where they had strongholds.
Now, they started using Agent Orange and other defoliants?
Yeah, very early in the war.
But along the riverbanks, where you were working, did they use it very much?
I remember seeing a helicopter spraying one time. We were definitely in areas that were sprayed heavily. The Rungsat Special Zone, which was kind of south-east of Saigon, not too far, was a mangrove swamp, and it was just annihilated with Agent Orange. I mean, you could see that everything was dead, and it was an area we would go into to test fire weapons, and we did carry out operations in there, and surprisingly, the VC were there, you know, and would come at us.
Okay. And what about the spraying of Agent Orange by 123s? Aircraft.
I don't recall seeing any of that in the air, but I saw the results of it.
You actually sprayed on. You hear some guy say that the aircraft flew overhead and sprayed this stuff and it landed on me.
No.
Okay.
But we were subjected to it in many different ways through the water. Our boats, the engineman would rig up a system where we could run the water through the engine and have warm water hose to shower on the back of the boat, you know. So we were subjected to it through the water, through food, through ice, through everything.
Okay. And let's see here. Rakia, interdiction group.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that as one of the operations
right.
that you participated. What was that about?
Again, it was the beginning phases, I believe, of the Sea Lords, and we went down. River Assault Squadron 13 and 15 went down in the Yumen Forest area where Americans hadn't been in a long time or had never been. Mm-hmm. And that could have been the longer operation that we were on. And we got shot up really bad down there. We had a lot of casualties, a lot of boats hit. By being hit, I mean with at least a B-40 or B-50 rocket or recoilless rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall working our way in on this small canal. There was no way in or out. And we got shot up. We retreated back out to patch our wounds and everything. And the next morning, the brass decided we were going in again, and so we started down exactly the same canal, and in the middle of the night, to this day I cannot figure out how they did it, but they lodged coconut trees in the bottom of this canal, which was about maybe 40 feet wide,
mm-hmm.
they X-braced them down in the bottom of the canal to the point where we couldn't push them out of the way with our boats. We had to bring in a demolition team, and they had divers had to go down and blow these out before we could go back in.
Wow.
And so, you know, it's just the enemy saying, you know, this is our territory. Don't come down in here. And so we went down in and got shot up again. You know, on Christmas or New Year's Eve night, New Year's Day, Mobile Riverine Force went through one of the longest ambushes ever, over an hour. And, you know, guys were out of ammunition. Boats were completely defenseless because they didn't have anything left, or barrels were melted down or whatever. So we were awarded the Navy Unit Commendation, which is the second highest award for a unit for that Rockjaw interdiction group operation. And later, a second Navy Unit award for our River on 15, and then we also got the Presidential Unit, which was the highest medal for extraordinary heroism.
Now, what were there other tactics or other obstacles, types of obstacles, besides the what you've already discussed, mines and both command and command detonated and just standard waterborne mines? Were there other obstacles they would set up, other types of obstacles, using natural, you know,
I can't.
Means or...
Yeah, I can't recall too many other than sniper fire. We, you know, we took sniper fire, but no.
No other engineering obstacles.
No, I don't.
Like the coconut tree.
Yeah, I don't recall any other incident besides that one. But
I don't know if there were areas where they could fall trees that were long enough to like block access and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't recall them doing that. But you know, mainly their tactic was. There were situations where they really like to ambush us, where we have terms for them, the crossroads, where we're two rivers kind of make an X. And when you, even though our boats were heavy, when we entered that X, the water pressure would push us. And you really had to maneuver to get your boat across it. And invariably, they like to ambush us there. And not just once. They would do it many different times, you know. And you'd think that tactically we could soften up the area around there before we got there, but they were always there, you know. And so, and then the Snoopy's nose tactic was to get us surrounding a curve in the river and attack both sides.
And then you guys shoot each other.
Yeah, but as far as engineering, I can't recall any other, you know, they... I've heard where with the PBRs they would string wire across the canal where the front gunner would be, you know, get hit by the wire or whatever, but I don't recall seeing that.
Did you end up putting front-mounted wire cutters, like on Jeeps?
No.
Did you end up putting those in your boats?
Not our boats. I don't know if the PBR did. I never heard of that.
Okay. All right, why don't you go ahead and, if you don't mind, describe the... that enemy, that action that you described on the questionnaire about Lieutenant Kelly, the question about the bravest action you witnessed.
Right. This was late in my tour. I think it was June 10th or 15th of 1969. We were getting very close to going back home. This incident happened about a month before we actually left on July 15th, but it was seven or eight boats. We were out on an operation. At this time, we were carrying the 9th Infantry U.S. troops, and it was our main base area was Dong Tam, but we were operating out of Ben Tre. And typical, you know, you'd go for a while with no action or anything, and we had just, as I recall it, we had, my boat had gone to the riverbank and dropped our ramp to pick up troops, and the citation kind of reads a little different than that, but our ramp cable broke, which the ramp itself is 4.5 tons, with the armor plating on it, and the only option you have at that time is to use a manual come along to bring that ramp up. And I don't recall any ramp cables breaking up to that point. But anyway, the other boats had picked up some troops, and I truly believe that we were ready to pick up troops, and the enemy attacked. And my position was in the well deck where the ramp was with the 50 caliber machine gun. I had 250s and 430 calibers to deal with down there. Anyway, so my position was to manually crank that ramp up. Well, I started to hook up the come along, and we got ambushed. And I very vividly remember the monitor boat coming alongside and firing into the jungle ahead of us, mm-hmm. in front of our boat, as I was cranking this ramp up, mm-hmm. which took, you know, it seemed like 50 minutes, but it probably took 10 minutes or 5 to 10 minutes to get it cranked up. And each time this monitor would fire, it would almost knock me over because I was way out in front of the muzzle blast. And in that time, the Lieutenant Kelly, Thomas Kelly, was on the monitor boat as our commander at that time on that small group of boats. And they took a B-40 or B-50 rocket right directly in the coxswain flat where the boat driver is and the boat captain and the lieutenant. And the shrapnel just, I didn't see it, but it shredded Lieutenant Kelly's face, knocked his eye right out of his skull and got his vocal cords and everything, knocked him down and got the boat captain too. And through the process, he continued to direct fire, even though he was gravely injured, to try to get us taken care of, because we couldn't back off the riverbank or we would flood with the ramp down. Mm-hmm. And sink. So after we got the ambush secured, the helicopter came in and took him away to the medevac hospital. And today, to this day, he credits the corpsman that was on board that saved his life due to the injuries. But later on, he was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for his actions in support of saving my boat and the other boats at the time. I happened to meet him at a reunion in '95, which was pretty nice to see the man after all these years.
Did he fully recover from his wounds?
Yeah, he went on in the Navy and ended his Navy career. I think he was a lieutenant commander when he retired, or a commander. Definitely disfiguring wounds and lost his left eye and stuff, but he made it.
And anything else? Any other actions that were similar or equal to that in terms of the bravery displayed?
Well, there was a lot of unsung bravery, I believe. Situations where guys stuck their necks out way beyond what was expected during ambushes, and it went unheralded. Unfortunately, I truly believe that one gripe that I have is that I believe all of our officers received bronze stars, silver stars, and whatnot, and Lieutenant Kelly justifiably the Medal of Honor. But I only recall one of our enlisted guys receiving a bronze star medal for putting out a fire on a boat in a critical situation. But there was a lot of bravery that went on that was just not seen, because you were in isolated situations with a 7-man crew, you know, that should have probably been rewarded, but it wasn't.
Okay. Well, let's see. Is there anything else you'd like to discuss about your in-country experiences?
Well, it was all so impacting to me that it's dominated my life ever since. Most of us, like I say, were 19, 20, mm-hmm. and uh, at an age where we were searching for what was going to happen in our life, and all of a sudden our lives were changed dramatically. I got somebody at the door, Steve.
Okay.
Could you call back in maybe 10 minutes?
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks.
Why don't you go ahead and talk about your trip back. You know, where did you arrive in the United States? How were you received?
Okay. I left Vietnam July 15, 1969. When you fly back, you're flying with time, so you arrive like 1 or 2 hours after you left their time. So it was kind of interesting there.
Mm-hmm.
But we flew from Tansanute to Okinawa. I think this time we flew in a military aircraft, C-130 or something like that. And then we left Okinawa and flew on into Travis Air Force Base in California. When we arrived, I was just so elated, as all of us, to just be back on American soil that I jumped off the ladder coming down and kissed the ground. I was
mm-hmm.
so excited. And then on our way to the terminal, I turned around and I heard a noise, and I saw the protesters had the front gate of the base all blocked off. And they had signs and everything, and they actually had Viet Cong flags and things like that. It was really confusing because up to that point, I hadn't really, you know, thought much about the protests going on. And when we got inside, we were briefed and told it would be better if we put civilian clothes on and kind of blended in rather than go to the San Francisco airport in our uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, we came home in greens, whatever OD greens we could find. We didn't have uniforms, official uniforms, but they authorized us to wear those. So it was a confusing time, and I remember, you know, making my way to San Francisco Airport and flying home, and it was just like most people were out of the loop on what was happening, what I'd gone through, and it was a confusing time. Of course, I was just fresh out, and I was for 2 or 3 years that I can remember, whenever I talked about Vietnam, my whole insides would shake, and I thought people could see it on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
It was so traumatic that I was, you know, physically affected as well as mentally and spiritually. So that was a shock to come home and have that going on. And of course, I was 4 years in the Navy, so I was headed back to Guam for another 18 months, which was, in retrospect, a real tough time for me.
How so?
You know, at that time, post-traumatic stress was not a legitimate medical term, so you know, I didn't know what was bothering me, but in retrospect, I can see that I had PTSD from my experiences in Vietnam very bad, to where I rebelled against the military, the system there on Guam, and got in trouble, got Article 15 for giving an obscene gesture to an Air Force colonel.
Wow.
in a staff car. And things like that, you know. I was really a mess and didn't really realize how bad.
What prompted you to make the gesture to the Air Force colonel?
We were drinking wine, a couple of us in there.
Okay.
And I was in the back seat, and we passed his staff car with the flag flying, and I just leaned out, gave him a gesture, and of course, dummy me, they just looked at the license plate and tracked us down.
Mm-hmm.
So.
What prompted you to go back to school? How long was it until you went back to school?
Actually, you mean for the ministry?
Yeah.
That was all done through correspondence.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was actually, most of it was done in Laos as missionaries. We were over there for 5 years, so.
Okay.
Most of it was done, all of it was done through extension.
Okay. Well, what was most important about the war as a personal experience for you?
Well, it really, you know, there's pluses and minuses, and I suppose the minuses kind of outweigh the pluses, but it made me a stronger individual as far as dealing with situations.
But then again, it made me it turned out to be a very controlling person. Everything has to be right around me, you know, to the point of toilet paper has to be properly put on the deal, you know, and the paper towel. And a really a passion to cover all bases, make everything right, almost to the point of obsession, you know, because we were faced in a situation where you had to be ready for the enemy. And when I got back, so many people were complacent that it really disturbed me. So I still am obsessed with making sure my perimeter is secure and that everything's in order,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I would say that, you know, there were strengths that came out of it by being able to deal with situations. If there's an emergency, I'll be the first one there to try to help where other people may step back, you know. But on the other hand, it's brought a lot of personal isolation and a real wall around my emotions to where I really can't, you know, deal with people very easily.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think we as a nation should take away from the Vietnam War?
Well, it's interesting that when it was winding down, that it was not popular to be a Vietnam veteran. We receded in the shadows. We avoided and evaded Vietnam talk or situations, unless it was amongst other Vietnam veterans who you could trust, who you knew were there, who understood what you were talking about. Even my own folks didn't understand. My dad tried to tell me that the government, U.S. government, did a great job in Vietnam, and one day I just tore up my citations and medals and ribbons and cut them up right in front of him just to show him that this country did wrong in Vietnam by stretching the war out and not supporting our allies as they promised they would, and eventually causing them to flee communism that we were fighting in the first place,
mm-hmm.
not going all out to win the war, you know, that, I suppose, was the toughest part. But I think, you know, administratively and politically, the government used the Vietnam War as a staging area to improve weaponry and at the cost of the individual soldier, sailor, and airman. And I think the Russians did the same thing in Afghanistan afterwards to catch up, you know, at the expense of their soldiers. And they suffer just as many Vietnam veterans do. So,
mm-hmm.
a lot of bad things happened. But on the other hand, I feel that perhaps we saved countries like Thailand and Singapore, Malaysia from communist rule by the efforts we made. I just feel there has to be some kind of justification for those who were killed and wounded,
mm-hmm.
and for the efforts, bravery, and everything that took place in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Let me go ahead and pause. Mm-hmm. This is CD number one. This is CD number two of the interview with Mr. Michael Harris. Sir, would you, your discussion just a minute ago with about your your talks with your dad about Vietnam, how did he respond when you cut up your awards and your citations and your ribbons?
Well, it really solidified my side of things, and it humbled him, I believe, to the point that he didn't press that patriotic gung-ho issue anymore. It was he began really listening to me, what I had to say, and what was wrong with the situation in the war, you know. And a lot of World War II veterans felt that way, and they ostracized the Vietnam veterans as being crybabies and whiners about the situation we were in. But hey, you know, we fought as hard as we could, just as they did, and sometimes longer and in, you know, than they did, and it was unfair to us that they would throw this thing at us that we lost the war and everything. We didn't lose the war. We won every major battle, and it was Congress that decided to pull out, not us. You know?
Mm-hmm. Did you personally run into that a lot, that kind of response?
Yeah, through the years, there was, you know, I just kind of remained quiet like a lot of other veterans. And, you know, today, I mean, every sitcom you see, there's a Vietnam veteran line in it or whatever, you know, and the movies and everything. It's cool to be a Vietnam vet, but for many, many years, it wasn't cool at all, you know, and it was sad because we went and did our part, but we got ostracized by our fellow peers for even taking part in the war, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
and what's interesting to me, you know, the Vietnam veterans are in the forefront now in leadership and in other categories, and there's many rap groups and ways to try to heal, but I often wonder, where are the protesters? Where are the rap groups for them? Where, you know,
mm-hmm.
they just blended into society, and now there are many of them are our leaders,
mm-hmm.
making decisions to send others to the same quagmire that we were in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So do you think that the government takes care of its veterans?
No, not adequately. I've personally helped a lot of veterans with VA claims, and it's a constant battle with the Veterans Administration to get benefits for these guys. You know, I mean, a good example is everybody that was in country was subjected to rocket mortar attacks or any type of lethal situation at any time. Yet the Veterans Administration says that if you have awards that show that you were in combat, then there's a sure ticket to a claim. But if you don't, if you were on a rear base or something, then you've got to prove that you had stressors, and you've got to prove to them that you were subjected to the fear that would qualify you for post-traumatic stress.
Mm.
Very unfair, you know. I mean, because, you know, you could have been killed at any moment.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think is the most important lesson we should take away from the Vietnam experience, the Vietnam War?
Well, that's a tough one because I'm unique in the sense that I came away with no patriotism, no allegiance to this country whatsoever. I've never voted, and I've been ostracized for that because I got to do my part, but I feel that I got burned that bad, so...
Mm-hmm.
Speaking from that viewpoint, it's tough to say that, you know, we got to do this administratively or politically. We've got to take action, and we can't have more Vietnams and all that stuff. It's just, from my personal experience, I would hate to see another 18, 19, 20-year-old put in a situation where the government basically withdrew and left, you know, for no reason at all, and left the dead and wounded behind, and then wouldn't care for him afterwards.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
Well, I really appreciate what you're doing with these oral interviews. And you know, I guess there's one thing that I've had a, if you call it a passion for, was mm-hmm. the issue on the prostitution in Vietnam. And,
mm-hmm.
and the availability, you know, it was like a kid in a candy shop. You just walk in, you can eat anything you want, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us were lured or subjected to that to the point where we got involved. And I admire guys that didn't, who were married or had religious beliefs, that they didn't become involved. But majority did, and I believe, like myself, many came away with sexually transmitted diseases. I personally still suffer from herpes today, genital herpes, as a result of one incident in February of 1969. And, you know, it seems to be a strong strain, and I truly believe that we Vietnam veterans brought this disease back from Southeast Asia and infected the country. Mm-hmm. Not to downgrade the veteran. It just happened, you
right.
know. And I fought the Veterans Administration for years to get it service connected,
mm-hmm.
and finally was successful and have a 10% compensation rating. And you know, a lot of veterans, I believe, have it, and it's recorded to a certain extent in their military records, but it doesn't say herpes because they didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
The medical professionals didn't know what it was. Back then, I came home on leave from Vietnam, and my family doctor misdiagnosed it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyway, I just the point of the magnitude of the impact that this prostitution had, not only with these diseases upon the veteran, but also through emotional stability and having relationships that were very short, were
mm-hmm.
very, very impersonal.
Mm-hmm.
I think those kind of things were carried over into their lives as
mm-hmm.
young men, and it impacted how they responded to the females in the United States and to their spouses and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But that, it isn't much talked about, so
right.
I always like to bring that up because I tell you, it was just rampant,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there were situations, too, where the clubs had slot machines, you know what I mean? You could go
mm-hmm.
into a club, it was like a casino or something, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it was almost bizarre. It was like the war progressed through the years to the point where a lot of people were making money off of the troops, you know, and it was, those kind of things kind of add up to a real confusing state of, you know, what... We're fighting a war here. We got slot machines and prostitutes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I just thought I wanted to mention that.
Okay. Anything else?
I think the impact of the return from a war situation has played a huge role in the psychic, emotional stability, mental stability. Stability of many of these veterans that I truly believe that the general public does not understand to the point that it's really damaged them by coming home. And you know, when we came home, the protesters were not just a bunch of hippies out there. They were churches, they were unions, they were people in high places that were saying basically to us that you were doing wrong without saying it directly to us. And we receive that message, and that's why we receded back into the shadows, because we had a false sense of guilt put upon us for doing what we thought was the right thing to do. What our forefathers would have done, we were ostracized for, so, and even by our forefathers, you know. So you know, I think the most important thing is for families and friends and whoever to really listen to veterans from the Vietnam War, to commend them for their efforts and to support them in any way they can, so they'll feel a bit more worthy. You know,
mm-hmm.
many are out there working themselves to death and drinking themselves to death just because they have no one that understands. So,
mm-hmm. okay.
I guess that's about it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
This will end the interview with Mr. Michael Harris.